Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.
Welcome to the Patrice Brantley Show. We're helping others is the name of the game, and on this show, we push purpose, positivity, but most importantly, personal growth. Today, y'all know how I feel about my mic, okay? But today, I am stepping out and flipping the tables. I will be interviewed by Mr. Kobe Richards. He is going to take over the driver's seat, and y'all know how this drives me. I will be the passenger and the viewee for this particular section. So I'm going to let him take over the show. You all enjoy, and let's just go ahead and have some fun.
All right, let's do this. Let's hop in, and glad to have you riding with me. No backseat driving today. I know that's going to be hard for you, but I'm going to turn the tables on you and do what you do to your guests. What is your story? What's your background and childhood story? Since you often like to surprise your guests with that little twist.
So what's my story? I was born and raised in Miami, and I am the oldest of me and my sister, two girls. And I was raised by a single mother. Parents were married, had a lot of domestic violence in the home. Okay. Ended up having to move out of my family's home and live away for about a year in Palm Beach, and came back years later. And it's just been a ride ever since. In the midst of this move and coming back, we jumped right back into wanting to help others, wanting to do well in the neighborhood.
Nice. Now, how old were you when that move out happened?
I was 8. Yeah, I had just turned 8, getting ready to turn 9. And I remember it so clear to this day. I literally went to school that day, and at the end of the bell, I had a bag packed and I was moved to the Palm Beach for the next year.
So you didn't even see this coming, this move?
No.
Wow. So you would have been about what, 3rd grade?
Uh-huh. Exactly.
So you march off, little Patrice with a backpack in the 3rd grade, thinking it's all good, or at least the good that you knew, the normal you knew. And you come home to find your world is turned upside down.
Totally upside down. I went to go live with my mother's stepsister, who I lovingly call my Aunt Glow. And it was just a whole new world.
What was that world like in contrast to what you'd come from?
So this world was even more crazy than the world I came from. I ended up going and staying with her husband, who was a part of the Palm Beach Sheriff's Department. And actually, he was the head of domestic violence for that department, only to discover, and their two children, only to discover that he was abusing my aunt as well.
Oh, my.
So we went from being in a house of, this is the crazy you know,
to this right,
you don't know, but you know parts of it, and trying to learn how to navigate working through it. So it just became an interesting experience. So this, for me, became me learning how to adjust on the fly, mm-hmm, and see the positive in no matter what goes on.
Yeah, that's fantastic that you were able to see how it happened for you instead of getting stuck in the to you. But wow, from the frying pan into the fire there.
Literally, that's how I feel.
So along this journey, somehow you developed, when did you first develop your love of education and wanting that to be a part of your life? Did that start during this childhood phase, or did that come later in life for you?
My love for education started very early. In my childhood neighborhood in Miami Gardens, it was known as Norwood then, but I loved it because there were just so many different, so many different avenues. And what I used to love was that you would see the teachers that would get dressed in the morning. And there was such an era of respect and honor. And I remember fondly my first grade teacher, Miss Turner, who I loved. And she just always had this air of excitement. And everywhere she went, she just exuded joy. And then my 3rd grade teacher, Miss Berman, who just went over and beyond. And I wanted to be like these women. I wanted to be these people who came and said, you know what, I see something in you. And from that point on, I was hooked. I just wanted to be a part of that camaraderie, that brother, that sisterhood of being an educator.
That's beautiful. What, when you changed location of residence, did you also change schools?
Yes. So I ended up going to an inner city school, is what they would call in this area. And I found some of the most interesting teachers. at that point, I had never encountered teachers that were just, they were good at what they did, but you could tell they had done it for so long.
Okay.
So bringing in a different fresh air was just something interesting. And what I remember the most about that move, this is going to sound real crazy, was this one young man named Chicken Wing. I will never forget this. That was his name. He literally, that was his nickname that they called him in school. And what I loved about him was he always knew how to make you laugh. And I just thought that was such a great thing. No matter what was going on in class, no matter how boring the subject may have been to me, he always found a way to make me laugh.
That's awesome. The power of humor helps cover a lot of these wounds, or at least helps ease the pain, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
So you go from there, third grade, where it sounds like you had kind of a suburban experience.
Yeah.
And then you go to the inner city, where now your teachers are teaching by rote or by muscle memory, not really giving a whole lot of thought, just going through the motions. Yeah. But that flame that got ignited early on stayed lit. How did that then transition into you becoming an educator? What happened from there?
For me, in the process of wanting to become an educator and kind of walk through it, I never forgot those women. When I did finally come back to Miami-Dade, I had my favorite teacher. Her name was Miss Evelyn Jackson. She was in fifth grade. This lady was 6 foot something tall, very, very strict, but she had a way of being strict and loving. And I just, I remembered that. Even if it took her taking a little bit of time out of her planning, she would say, "You're going to get this. We're going to make sure you have it before you leave here today." And I mean, I just remember that with so much joy that she was that person that always went over and beyond for us. And then I met a whole host of other great teachers. My eighth grade teacher, Mr. Mott, Mr. Talbert, who I had for band, Mr. Hoffman, who I had for band. I met just amazing people who along the way just kept that flame lit and just flourished with so much joy. And they really enjoyed what they did. And then once I got into it and actually decided, I went to FAM, Florida A&M. University. And when I got there, just meeting the professors that I met and how they instilled how important it was and what you were doing. This was not just a job. You were walking in a place to make an impact. And I was like, yes, I love this. This is what I'm here for. And it was just a beautiful thing. And at that point, yes, I'm taking us back old school. I was a Whitney Houston girl. I'll never forget my internship. This was like my theme song every morning. I got up. I believe the children are the future. I did that every day.
Nice.
Oh my gosh, probably the first 3 years of my teaching career.
That's, hey, nothing wrong with that. We will always love you. So
right here. I love that.
So it's amazing how these people made these little deposits in you over the years. And that was more formative and powerful than I think they probably even knew, and carried you through things that they didn't even know you were going through. So tell me, what was there a specific, having your backstory, was there a specific grouping of kids that you felt called to teach, a specific type?
When I first got into teaching, I just knew I wanted to make an impact. And it's funny that you say that, because the first group of kids I had, I was teaching in an inner city school. And at this point, I was teaching, it's called Alternative Education with the Comet Lab. Now, I'm aging myself a little bit because they don't even have these programs anymore. But in this program, you would go in, you would work with the kids that pretty much, they would say, these are the kids nobody else wants to work with, make it happen. And when you got here, at this point, when I first went in, I was the fifth teacher. There had been four other teachers who had said, yeah, this is a tad bit much for me, I'm out. And I will never forget the young man who left before I stepped in. And I remember him saying this to me. He goes, "Oh, they got a young one, fresh out of college, huh?" And I go, "Hi, nice to meet you." Not thinking about this at all. Right. And he goes, "Well, I tell you what, good luck." And he just storms out. He's like, "I'm over
wow.
it." And at this point, I'm like, okay. So I go in and I'm all excited, and I'm staying up late at night to create these plans. And I just knew this was the group. This was the group is that just, it was tough, it was rough, but they made it worth it.
So how much do you think your experience took this role of a teacher from profession to calling?
I saw myself in a lot of those kids.
Yeah.
So for me, I knew Where other people may have said, yeah, she's not that baby. Yeah, she's not the smartest of the group. She needs a little more help. You know, that was when I realized it's for you to come in and implant into these babies to kind of sow some seeds to help them see what other people don't see. This particular school that I was at when I first got there, they were on the list to pretty much be shut down at one point because of their testing scores and things of that nature. But once we got in here and I met some dynamic teachers who really just kept encouraging me, having that staff support and really knowing for myself, that kid is you. That kid that's sitting there that's going, yeah, I'm over this. I don't know what their backstory was all the time. I found out later for one of my kids who was one of my most troubled ones that, you know, in that process, I just thought, okay, I'm coming in here. I'm going to do this. And what people don't realize is teaching is so much more than just curriculum. And if you just come in and you're focused on just, I'm going to teach this out this book, they're going to get it. You're not doing your job. And that's when I realized it became more than just teaching from a book to actually walking in a calling. I'm going to give you one of my stories about my little person. So one of my little people, when I first got here, and when I first got to the school, I would hear this every day. Hey, lady, you gonna come back tomorrow? And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna come back.
So and you had the old teacher and the kids giving you these kind of pep talks.
This is wonderful, right? Isn't this the way to say, come on into the profession? Yeah. So I have the teacher who has told me, good luck. I have the kids who asked me for the first 3 months that I taught every day faithfully, hey, you coming back tomorrow? I'm going to come back tomorrow. We're going to be here. And they would do this every time I would say, well, hey, homework for tonight is, they go, so are you going to be here to pick it up? What's I'm going to be here tomorrow. Like, what's going on? And what was so interesting about this group of kids was it was this one young boy. And I never thought of it, never paid any attention. When I first got here, after he got comfortable, he would say, you smell like my mom.
Oh.
And I was like, what does that mean? I didn't understand it. He would say that to me all the time, never paid any mind about it. And as time went on during this time period, we would get here. And I'm just one of those people, I'm pretty sure now, they would probably be like, don't touch him. But he was just one of those kids, every time he needed a hug, he would get a hug. Every time something went on, some babies just need that. And in this process, through this time that I was there, he ended up with pink eye. Strangely, I ended up with pink eye. He had ringworm. I ended up with ringworm. We had everything. He had a stomach virus. I ended up with a stomach virus. And I remember he just would keep saying, you just smell like my mom. You smell like my mom. And at the end of the year, when graduation came, I met his father. And I will never forget this. The father says to me, he goes, I had to come out here to see the woman that made a difference. And I went, who are you talking about? Because at this point, I'm like, sir, like, it's not that big a deal. Like, I'm barely 21 at this point. And he's like, you don't understand. He was like, every night, my son would come home and cry and tear up the house because he missed his mom. He said, I don't know what you do in here, but he stopped coming home and doing this and eventually started smiling.
Oh, my.
And I didn't know at this point his mother had passed away. I had no clue of this. And I just thought, I'm just going in here to teach. That's all I'm doing.
Yeah.
That's all it is. I had no clue that me going in here being me, being silly and cutting up and just being who I am was making this big of a difference. And that's when I realized, yeah, you need to do this. This is
So you got to experience the other end of what you received. When teachers led with relationship with you, you got to see how it impacted from the teacher's viewpoint, and then had the benefit of hearing the backstory of the transformation that this had on this young man.
That's one of the days when he got really, really tough later that I had. Yeah. And to this day, I still smile about it because so many people have people that impact their lives and they never get to hear about how they impact their lives.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
During those tough days, during the days where you're getting the good luck, Are you going to show up again? How did you cope with all of that?
How did I cope? So here's how this works. I'll never forget her. Her name was Miss Brenda and Miss Linda and Miss Geraldine. These were the three ladies that worked on this team. These were your vets of the school. And there were days that I would just be like, am I really cut out to do this? Like, this is way more than what I thought. And I will never forget, every evening, right before they leave, they would go, you made it through the day, Brantley. Made it through the day. Don't worry about it. I had, one of them was very much into their alcohol. I was not. They would go get your ice cream. They used to laugh at me. They go, that's the one I like, ice cream. Go get your ice cream. Come on back tomorrow. Find another day.
Right.
And I thought it was so interesting because these ladies had no idea what that meant for me.
Mm-hmm.
And there were days that I was just like, okay, I believe the children are the future, but I really, this ain't this future looking a little rough. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing.
I believe it, but I'm not feeling it right now.
Exactly. And they just, that support and knowing that somebody cares and seeing that, you know what, hey, we've been there too. We understand what it's like for them first few days when you're trying to get your footing and things are changing rapidly. So I want to shout out those ladies for the amazing stuff that they've done and how they've helped me to make it.
So clearly this mentally affected you, and you were fortunate enough to have the support system around you to help you cope with it. Therefore you learned how important this was. They showed you that. What other lessons did you learn from either the students or the teachers?
Some of the lessons that I learned in this process. Wow. Definitely from the teachers. That is your queendom, as we would say on our road. That is your queendom. Take hold of your throne and don't give it up. That was first. That meant in their eyes, when you walk in that room, you own it, make it happen. There's no one else. You got it.
Right.
The other things I learned from my students, compassion. Have compassion and understand that their story matters too. Mm. And the biggest lesson, if I learned nothing else, relationship over academics. I think for so many people, especially in this day and age of COVID, where everything is computerized and you got to get it this way. And if you don't get it this way, then you won't get it. And, you know, I think about these babies, and I think about myself. I was not a computer kid.
Mm-hmm.
First, I didn't have it. But then two, once it came, it wasn't something like, oh, I got to do this now. And every kid is not a computer kid.
Right. Some
kids need you to take a little more time with them to sit down and say, this is how you do this. This is how this goes. So, you know, that was a big piece for me. The big lessons, they just gave me so many more.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, there's so many lessons in this that connect to me daily that I still hold dear.
Yeah. So within all of that structure of this, the school that you've gone to, you're this young new teacher, a lot of what you talk about is burnout. Did you start to experience, once you got your legs under you and felt like you had some competence, did you start to feel some burnout, or was it forever, you know, daisies and butterflies?
Well, no, it definitely wasn't all daisies and butterflies. The burnout for me happened when that school program closed. And I ended up having to move from that particular school to another school. And when I got to this other school, it had its challenges, but not those challenges. And when I got there, that's when I learned a whole lot about the politics that go along with education and how sometimes people don't see the whole impact of a child. They just see the test score of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it was around my ninth year that I really started to have burnout. I started getting the same type of kid daily, every year. It was kind of like, they would joke and say, okay, we have a Brantley special for you. Like, that was a joke. I would get more difficult, the more difficult kids. And I was like, you know what? That's okay though. Because I always got a chance to see those babies go from being a little bit difficult to soaring when it was all over. And I loved it. But the burnout started my ninth year.
It started
with feeling overwhelmed.
Okay.
Kind of feeling like I couldn't quite catch my breath at all times. It went from, okay, I am the superwoman, but now even superwoman needs a break. Even
right.
Volunteer, that kind of thing.
So was the idea of changing schools itself difficult for you, or did it just become, this is what's happening, I accept it, move on, and then the difficulty began with the new school?
It wasn't hard to move. Okay. Because at that point, it's kind of like, there's no other door. You can't go back.
Right.
Kind of like, you know, we don't have a position for you. There is no money and funding. You have to go to this new place. When I went to the new place, it was very different because I had dealt with kids, but now this is a different type of kid.
Sure.
So where I was dealing with student A who had issues with, maybe I watched my brother get shot last night. In student A. Now I was dealing with, I'm entitled and you can't do this. And I'm like, wait, what? Hold on. Wait, your parents go along with this? Why are they going along with this? So it was a very different type of kid to deal with, but also not having that support, kind of being in an island of your own and just having to say you can make it happen. That was a big piece for me.
So it almost sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like it was almost the reverse of your story. You went from suburb school to inner city school. And then when you were teaching, you started out in more of a, you know, urban environment and then went to the suburbs.
Yeah, and that's what I thought it was. Don't be fooled by the dirt and the grass, let me tell you. Don't be fooled by the paint and the grass on the grass.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just a space that I got there. What I had at the first school was a lot of love, a lot of support, a lot of, you know, these babies need you. Let's push and do. To a space of, okay, they'll get it or they don't. And that's not what I was there for. I knew that, you know, I saw more.
Yeah. Yeah. So was there any good in this new school?
The good was I saw what it was like to be in a place that got proper funding.
Okay.
It was great to see that if you said, hey, I need this for my class, or we need more, you know, materials, like it was there. Like you didn't have to go so much in your own pocket to get these materials. The other part of that made this a good school for me was the relationships with the teachers. Once I started being that mouth and being like, we should get together. Like once I became that, like we should collaborate on some stuff. Then it helped people to see, I don't have to be in an island on my own. I don't have to be over here trying to figure this out. And I found that was something that was very helpful for the crops of teachers that came after me. I would say, if you need anything, reach out. Hey, I'm in this room. Let's work together. It makes a difference. People don't realize that. Instead of it being a competition, make it a collaboration. Absolutely. Everybody wins when you do it that way.
Yeah, it's gold right there.
So that's what made that wonderful for me.
So it sounds like one of the big takeaways was, with the ability to experience both, you came to realize in a powerful way that it's not about funding or lack of funding. It's about being committed to the mission.
That's it.
And if you're committed to the mission, amazing things can happen. If you're all about the funding, not that it's not important, schools need funding, but if that's the driving force and sitting around in your abundance, your outcome's not going to be all that great.
What I found was when we got focused on the money, people forgot the compassion. And here's the big piece. Yes, you need the money. I would never say you don't. Please, y'all, give money.
Right.
Put in, help these teachers who need it, because there are a lot of teachers who don't get the opportunity to have the materials that they need. So please do that. But also, the schools that do get, don't forget to pack your compassion.
Yeah.
It's not just, hey, this is child A. This is somebody's child that's going to eventually become an adult. And you want them to know how to treat others, how to respect others.
Did you find that there was any different expectation from the parents in these two environments where there was the abundance, the larger funding, that the parents had more expectations for what the school was supposed to do with their kid and how the school was supposed to fix their kid?
Oh, yeah. What I found was, some parts of it is yes and some parts no. So let me talk about the yes. The differences were that both parents had an expectation. That was the same across the board. Everybody had an expectation. What the expectation was and how it could be met, that was the difference. And what I found interesting, in schools that didn't have necessarily the money, I had a lot more parents that were saying, tell me how I can help. What can I do? And it's interesting that you use the word fix, because that drives me. I always tell people, we don't fix humans, you heal.
Right.
And you work to help them out. Where there was a lot more money, it was a little more hands-off. Hey, this is your job. You make it work.
Yeah.
And that was the biggest piece. I was like, no. We're not becoming hands-off. This is our baby. And I would tell that to mothers and fathers with them both present. This is not just mine. This is your assignment. They're going to be with you for the rest of your life. So it became the thing of, I want your connection for them. I want them to see that you're a part of that. This is important. Money can raise a child, but it can't do the full job.
So you found that the absence of funding created the presence of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
And the reverse happened. When the funding was there, the collaboration went away, and now you were supposed to be the fixer. So that had to have been just tiring and exhausting, especially from the more collaborative experience you had had. When did the burnout start in that environment?
In that environment, by year 11, because I just knew. I was like, yeah. And it became me getting to the point where I just lived life in burnout. I got to the point where I became that teacher that I had met in Palm Beach. It was kind of like, okay, so we're here. This is what the book says. Get it. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that for myself, because I knew that was not me. I don't like to be able to just go in and, okay, well, I'm here. Let me give you this exact time to time. That wasn't me. I didn't like it. And then what I also found in it, as the burnout was going, I was doing a lot of physical stuff. It would get to the point the headaches now would turn into migraines, and they wouldn't go for days, where I could take an aspirin before and be okay. It wasn't happening. Now I'm not sleeping. So now I'm looking like a raccoon talking to people. And I don't like this at all, because now people are looking at me going, what's wrong with you? And I'm saying in my head, if you only knew,
right,
I'm trying to teach your kid, and you're not here in the process. The other part that I started to notice was I was starting to get anxiety. And I didn't know it at the time it was anxiety until I started working with people with anxiety. Because I was just like, oh, everybody gets that little nervousness when you pull into the parking lot. Everybody gets like this big, like, struck of fear when you pull into the yard. And I was like, is that normal? Like, I really started to get to that point where that was the calm, and it was so used to it. And then one day I was having a conversation with another teacher from a different school, and the teacher goes, don't you enjoy pulling up into your parking lot? And I'm going, no. Every day I pull up in the parking lot, I have my heart in my throat. Mm-hmm. I'm like sitting here praying over time, going, okay, do I get out? Do I not? Do I get out? Do I not? I can still pull out. The kids haven't seen me yet. Like, it was happening that way. So
right.
I realized, yeah, this is not your normal thing. And then what made it worse, at this point I had ballooned. I had went from a good maybe 200 to now 237 and counting, mm-hmm. and climbing. So yeah. Now I was taking solace in food and other things to try to make it through at this time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So the coping became, your first battle of each day became simply getting out of the car in that parking lot.
Yes.
Before you ever even stepped foot in the classroom to deal with what you needed to deal with on that particular day. So from there, what happened? So, and to clarify, are you talking about an additional 11 years after that first 9?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're 20 years in now.
Yep.
You're not wet behind the ears anymore. You've got your legs under you, and it's not an absence of competence. It's flat out burnout with what you're doing. How did you respond then once you became aware that I don't think this is normal? Now I'm having conversations with other people who are talking about feeling joyful getting out of their car in the parking lot, and that's not my experience. What did you do at that point?
So at this point, I had a couple decisions to make. I had to be honest with myself and say, is this the life that you wanted for yourself? You've always wanted to impact others. Yes, I still want to do that. And I find joy in impacting others. But the way this was happening, I was drowning while I was still trying to impact others. So the first thing I did, I went to my doctor first. And I was like, hey, we need to talk. Something's off. So I want to make sure first that I'm healthy. That was the first thing. Second thing, we had a conversation of, you need to admit to yourself, sis, get in the mirror, this is not the life you wanted. And be honest, because I think for a lot of people, when we talk about that burnout piece, it's being honest and saying, is this the life you pictured for yourself? And being bold enough to say, now this is not the life that I've pictured, I got to change some stuff. And that was the hardest piece, being honest enough with myself and saying, hey, I have to admit, and now I got to change something. And I think at so, I think at so many pieces and so many points, I had given myself this, but if you leave, this is what's not going to get done. But if you leave, this is not going to get done. So once I started to admit and I started to make changes, I had to honestly do two types of seeking. I had to seek one, my higher power, which is Jesus. I had to seek and say, okay, God, this clearly is not it. What do I do?
Yeah.
Because that was a big piece for me, because I just knew from a little girl, I wanted to impact somebody. I wanted to be like those teachers that I saw. I wanted to be that one that, you know, 30 years from now, they're driving great cars, beautiful homes, and they were happy. So I had already saw the end goal and I knew what I wanted it to be, but how to get there was part of the process. And, you know, really the piece that I couldn't figure out. The second part of seeking was I had to honestly be honest and seek professional help. I had to break down and go to a counselor. In my community growing up, counseling was not discussed. How dare you go tell your business, no matter of fact, not even your business, go tell the business of your house to some outsider. You don't air the family's dirty laundry.
Right. You know,
that was a big piece for me understanding it's okay. I mean, I always had my faith. I always was in prayer and I did things of that nature, but it wasn't highlighted that you might need to go talk to somebody. It was honestly looked down upon, and literally people would say this, oh, they crazy, that you don't need to do what they're doing. They crazy. And I'm like, no, I'm not crazy. I'm just having a moment right now. I'm having a moment of crisis that I need to change up something in my life. So getting past that stigma and understanding that counselors are there for you to have someone to talk to be a sounding board, to be objective and say, so now you realize it's not what you want. Let me help you get to where you, what you want. And that was a huge piece. And being honest with myself, sitting down daily journaling, sitting down and saying, what does your joy, what does it look like to fill your cup without food, because that was my thing, daily in this process. And it took me a little while. It took me a little while to find the right counselor.
Yeah.
Someone who understood, because I had run into a couple that was like, but they're so innocent children. And I was like, when's the last time you understand? Like, I've had kids steal from me. I had kids boost my car. When have you been around these little innocent kids?
Right.
And, it was just something to see. But once I had the right counselor where I felt I could be open and honest and not judged, it was the best thing.
Yeah. Not only when have they been around those kids, when have they been around those kids' parents?
Exactly. Hello. That's the whole word right there.
So what I'm hearing you say is once you became aware that something was off, a big step to your burnout and the freedom that you've now grown into was not just having conversations with people who were equally miserable or struggling or things like that, because, you know, we know that that turns into just a cesspool of drama, but actually having conversations with people who were fulfilled in the profession, who were fulfilled in the same role. And by them talking about their experience and how it was fundamentally a different experience at that point for them than it was for you in the same role, you could then glean and say, okay, is there something I need to tweak to make it fulfilling again? Or as you found for yourself, is it time to pivot?
In that time to pivot, it was me being open and honest and going back to another childhood dream, because my childhood dream was always to teach. And I think that's the part that people don't realize. Burnout doesn't mean you hate what you did.
Right.
The experience you had wasn't the best experience for you.
Yeah.
And in that, when I pivoted, I realized, okay, there's a different way of doing this. I had to get unwound and I had to honestly unlearn what I thought happiness was going to look like. I had to look at, there's a new different version of happiness for me now.
Yeah.
In that process, it took me going, okay, teaching's not it. get out your feelings. That was a big one. Get out your feelings. You're not a failure.
Right.
Now, let's move to the new dream.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in that new dream, it turned into counseling.
And in that new journey, I'm willing to bet that you're using a huge part of what that first season taught you.
Oh, yeah. This season has taught me to have that compassion, mm-hmm. be understanding, not judgmental, but make sure that you're taking care of you first.
Yeah.
It's great to be a caregiver to everybody, but the caregiver has to take care of the caregiver first. You can't Ooh. Pull out of an empty cup.
That sounds like a major key in avoiding and working through burnout right there. This is this has been powerful. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for letting me flip the tables and actually share my story. So now y'all listen, y'all got a chance to get into this conversation about, you know, what it was and burnout. I need you to jump into the comments. Share your story. Are you at a point where you're feeling some burnout? Maybe you're in that point where you're pivoting. Maybe you say, Patrice, I am over. I am done. Hallelujah. I am out. And I'm doing great. Share it in the comments. Make sure you share this with a friend. And I want to thank y'all for tuning in to the Patrice Brantley Show, where helping others is the name of the game. And on this show, we push purpose, positivity, and personal growth.
Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.